for dinner, and it's Tuesday
or
night.
Or a Mexican.
Or don't call me illegal, whatever you do. If it's Tuesday night in Las Vegas, it's subject to discussion time. The program is podcasted as well on lvrocks.com. Thank you for everybody listening to the podcast. Thank you very much. And also, it's part of the antiradio.net podcast. Thank you. And also the podcast feed over at the Meeker Broadcasting, which the program is on at a rosy hour on the weekend. It's 7 a.m. Eastern. You got to wake up at 4 a.m. out here to listen to it. I don't know. But anyway, I thank him for at least putting the podcast up and running it. So that's good for us, I guess. And the website is subject number 2 discussion. And email is subject number 2 discussion at lvrocks.com. And the producer in charge, of course, is the Centurion, Alfredo Bendito Centurion. Anyway. We can have a little fun with this. I mean, for crying out loud. And before I get to the newly fangled news to you segment, which was actually I've had people I know from around the country and my family send newspaper headlines from all over the country, so that's gonna be a little different. And first of all, I'm gonna get to the headline in the today's Las Vegas Review. After the news to me and the news to you would be Ken Palman is the online producer for the Spokesman Review newspaper from Spokane, Washington, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and the Inland Northwest. So that'll be interesting. See what's going on up there and how everything's like the protests, everything played up there in Spokane. And before I delve into the news to you would be, of course, the Las Vegas Review Journal had on its front page today, thousands march on the Strip. They pretty much put a stranglehold on the Strip. They started downtown Tuesday, and then they ended up marching all the way down to the New York Hotel and Casino, which has a replica of the Statue of Liberty there. So that's where they congregated as a symbolic nod towards Ellis Island and then the real New York City. And so thousands, and they say that crowd stuns tourists, snarls traffic along resort corridor. A lot of the tourists were shocked. They apparently had no idea this was happening. I mean, these people live under a rock. Or they don't watch the news or read the papers. Deneen Wilson, a 42-year-old tourist from Virginia, was stuck at the Fashion Show Mall, which is in the middle of the Strip across from the new Wynn Hotel, for more than an hour waiting for a cab. She said in the paper, "This is wild. I've never seen anything like this before. This is history." So, and the casinos apparently reported no disruptions in their, I don't know about that, but I don't know where they... Where I worked, we had some disruptions because half the people didn't show up for work. So, but anyway, and what else? Shopping centers go empty. So the Bonanza Indoor Swap Meet with its 37 vendors was dark. Protesters' demands stir doubt. So the columnist John L. Smith says, "Illegal immigrants in the Valley contribute much to the community, but take much from it too," he says. So that was interesting. And then also the USA Today had, of course, more than a million rally for rights. 400,000 rally in Chicago, 600,000 in L.A., 75,000 in Denver. And sour news, and also at the before you get to the fold, in the middle of the paper is the sour news for the GOP in the poll. And I'm trying to think where this picture was taken. I think it was in Grant Park. Sour news for the GOP in the poll. Bush rating hits new low. Voters lean Democratic. So Bush's approval rating is now at 34%, according to the USA Today Gallup poll. And at the bottom it says, new antipsychotic drugs carry risks for children. Side effects can lead to bigger health problems down the road. So, and their snapshot, sales booming for vacation and investment homes. Number of second home sales in millions last year was 3.34 million. So, and also I had the story on the side here about Anna Nicole Smith, who looks very attractive now since she lost all that weight. Wins the latest battle round in millions left by a late tycoon husband. So, and on that, to move on to the news to you segment, the newly fangled version. So, this one is at the headline from today's San Diego Union Tribune. And at the top, it lists Denver, Chicago, New York with pictures of the protesters. And it has Colorado State Highway Patrol officers watched from the Capitol as tens of thousands of demonstrators rallied yesterday in Denver, calling for Congress to enact immigration reforms. And also in Chicago, marchers crossed the Jackson Street Bridge in a show of support for granting expanded rights to illegal immigrants. More than 400,000 Immigrants and their supporters marched yesterday through Chicago. And then New York, of course, had they filled Union Square yesterday in New York City to rally against House legislation, blah, blah, blah. And as San Diego takes supporting role in vast immigrant boycott, thousands skip work, school, and join rallies in L.A. to New York. School attendance last Monday, they ran down some of the neighborhood, the school districts, the Cajon Valley School District. Absent on Monday was 13%, and last Monday was only 5%. Chula Vista, the percentage of students absent Monday was 17.6%, and a week ago was only 5% as well. And it goes to Escondido K through 8, 22.2% are absent from school on Monday versus 4.1% from week before. The highest is in highest national. Must be a national school district. It must be called, I don't know. They have 6,000 students. 25.7% missed school on Monday versus 8.2% from the week before. So, yeah, it's amazing. And then Sweetwater, another big one, 36,000 students enrolled. Absent yesterday on Monday was 29.7% of their students was missing from school. Border protests block lanes. Impact varied across the county. And cost rising, and at the bottom it says, cost rising, try Zimbabwe with inflation nearly 1,000%. So, and what else? They had a Marine drowning is blamed on the Corps. Investigators report cites colossal safety failures, institutional failures, and colossal lapses in safety led to the death of Staff Sergeant Andrew Jason Gonzalez last summer in a pool at the Marine Corps recruit depot, according to a report obtained Monday by the San Diego Union Tribune. So that's horrible. And then below that, they had the Bolivian leader nationalizes natural gas. The president of Bolivia ordered the military to occupy the country's natural gas fields on Monday after nationalizing the energy sector and threatening to expel foreign companies if they do not sign new contracts within 6 months. So that was interesting. And then this one also from the Salinas, California newspaper, thousands protest. Salinas police estimate 13,000 turned out in Salinas. The picture has a bunch of them blocking off the street here. Separate marches meet up Monday at the intersection of El La Salle Street and Sanborn Road in Salinas as part of the National Day of Action. What else? Marchers span life spectrum. They go from older to young and pretty much all nationalities in between. So, and then the next one we have here is from the Long Beach, California, the Press Telegram. And this is a day to be heard of a big picture of these marchers going through L.A. Wow, look at this sea of people here. And contributions to society stressed at many large and peaceful rallies. And National Day of Boycott, talk about that as well. Basically, it's the whole front of the paper looks like it's just a picture, the big picture going through with all the protesters. And this one's from West Hawaii today. Here we go. No mention on the front page. Well, there's no pictures, no big splash of the protest. It says, Big Island soldier killed in Iraq. Hilo man remembered for sense of humor, duty, and purpose. After more than 3 years of conflict, the Big Island has lost its first soldier in the Iraq War. Army Sergeant Steve Sakota, 29, a Hilo resident, died Saturday in Baghdad when his Humvee hit an improvised explosive device, better known as a roadside bomb. And also on the right, Hawaii County Police, new officers hit the streets. Shortage still a problem. Talking about how there's a shortage of police. Police vacancies, 22 vacancies of 87 positions. North Kohala. Two vacancies of 12 positions they have, I guess, on their force. South Kohala, four vacancies out of 27 positions they have. And I can't read this other one. So, and agriculture harbor bills expected to pass the legislature. So they're immigration protest is actually up in the top. Nation World will be page 3A. So that's where that was put. And then we have this from McAllen, Texas, from the Monitor. And it says, I locked eyes with the killer. Witnesses to McAllen's shooting struggle with disbelief. A day after three people were shot to death at a party in the city's north side, Aziz Chaouri was reliving a horror no one wants. The 21-year-old McAllen resident saw his best friend since childhood, Rene Rodriguez, gunned down before his eyes around 3 a.m. on Sunday. Chaouri said, "I locked eyes with the killer." And then they have the call to arms with the protest. Diabetes drug might help to treat Alzheimer's. So apparently there's a link now between diabetes and Alzheimer's now. So that's interesting. And local schools in that area are on the rise on elite list. Two Rio Grande Valley schools are included in Newsweek's 2006 list of nation's top 100 high schools. And the May 8th issue hits newsstands this week, ranking the Science Academy of South Texas at number 11 and the South Texas High School for Health Professions, wow, at number 91. So, and talk about the protests. Protesters shut down Hidalgo Bridge, descend upon McAllen's Archer Park. So that's from McAllen, Texas. So, and this next one is from the Lake Sun from Camdenton, Missouri. Serving the Lake of the Ozarks region since 1879. That's an oldie. This is also from today. Let's see. Little impact felt. Nationwide call for immigrant labor protests not evident at the lake. Legal immigrants' allies began boycott to flex economic muscle. They had that story, actually, they had in there from Homestead, Florida. More money in sight. House passes Senate measure to increase Water Patrol funding by raising boat fees. This is in Missouri. A large contingent of Missouri Water Patrol officers congratulated Representative Wayne Cooper and Senator Luann Ridgeway with a standing ovation after the Missouri House of Representatives passed the Senate version of a bill to increase the funding on Monday afternoon. So apparently they're going to increase Water Patrol, have more patrols on their water by raising the boat fees. So, and what else? Showdown looms in Grove Hills, I guess it is. Alzheimer's patients to test diabetes drug and theory linking the two illnesses together. And right here, some of the stuff is. And also, this next one's from Kane County, Illinois, from the Kane County Chronicle. The top, they have a tour of Chicago's lakefront on bicycle. And they also have a gay marriage on the November ballot. Like I've said before, they're going to put this on the ballot because Rove is trying to drive out all the conservative voters to vote like he did the last time around. So he'll be trotting this out again. This is an oldie but a goodie for them. It's like favorite hits there. And also they have on the front page, on the top is a national issue, hits home. A picture of the rally in Los Angeles, a rally in New York, and in Aurora, Illinois. Estimated 10,000 people walk across the Illinois Street Bridge. They cross the Fox River during Monday's immigration rally in Aurora, which is a small town west of Chicago. Message in Chicago they have here says, "We are America." They have a little girl draped in an American flag. Nancy Vega, 17 months old, watches demonstrators Monday march through downtown Chicago to show support for immigration rights. And what else? Second trial for a shooter begins. Our Marcinowski remains in jail. Stephen Marcinowski fired several shots at a sheriff's deputy, but his attorney said it was a suicide mission, not an attempt to harm the officer. So apparently this guy, he claims it was suicide. He wasn't actually trying to kill the police officer. So he's on trial a second time. And also at the bottom, it says, headed in the wrong direction. Social Security and Medicare finances deteriorated in 2005. So, and also we had that thing that the Social Security Trust Fund and the Medicare Trust Funds are going to run out of money, I think, 2 years sooner than they were originally supposed to. And on the side, they have a story about sports, but the White Sox hanging on to win over the Indians. Manning confident as Bears' first pick. About Daniel Manning, going to be the Bears' first pick in the NFL draft. Is the third time a charm for the Popcorn Depot. I never knew this thing even existed in that area. The historic Batavia Popcorn Depot is set to move back to North Water Street after two other locations did not work out. The depot had been on the North Water Street for many years. That's news to me. I had no idea it was even there. And also it says the Clydesdales to Klopp in Geneva. The famed Budweiser Clydesdales are creating history Friday as they make their way into downtown Geneva to celebrate the 5th anniversary of the Old Town Pub. So I went standing back with one of them horses. And then this follows up with the next one from Elkhart County, Indiana. It's called The Truth. And The Truth Shall Set You Free. I don't know. making a point. Immigrants stage protest in Elkhart Hundreds rally on Civic Plaza to call for reform. A picture of the hundreds of them railing around the city square there. And in Elkhart County, some factories feel the impact. And at the bottom it says, in nation, some skip work, close shop to flex economic muscles. And also it says, brain decay link is scary. Again, they're all talking about this Alzheimer's, diabetes link. The article says, a provocative new theory suggests that one root cause of Alzheimer's disease is linked to diabetes, a theory about to be tested in thousands of Alzheimer's patients given the diabetes drug Avandia in hopes of slowing brain decay. So it's a scary scenario. Alzheimer's already is expected to skyrocket as the population grays, rising from 4.5 million sufferers today to a staggering 14 million by 2050. And also at the bottom, they have to be sure to vote and you take your ID with you. Government photo is required to vote. Absolutely. Absolutely. Voters, don't forget to vote today in Elkhart, Indiana. Don't forget that a government-issued photo ID is required to vote this year. So it's common sense. You know, have your ID with you for crying out loud if you're going to vote. I mean, it's good grief. Yeah. Can we get into the 21st century, please? And also we had this from the Lewiston, Maine. This is also from today, from the Sun Journal in Lewiston, Maine. A boycott impact far and wide. Again, they had that little picture of the little girl wrapped in the flag. Businesses around nation close up shop during boycott. Playmate wins right to pursue millions. That's the Anna Cole Smith story. Fire cause remains a mystery. Three Lewiston fires during weekend under investigation. State and local fire inspectors spent most of the day Monday poking through the rubble at the former Curran Beet Sprout Company warehouse on Spring Street after fire gutted the building the day before. No definitive cause was released. Police and fire investigators are probing that blaze, as well as a pair of others that burned a home and an empty mill over the weekend. Interesting. Auburn pays most in the state for school chief's travel costs. And also Northern Spike move into Sebago, tomato, tomato, I don't know. Size of one caught in April indicates fish are breeding in the lake. So, good for them. What else? And this is from... this is from Monday, actually, from the Vancouver Sun from Vancouver, Canada. Seriously, West Coast since 1912. Parental smoking. Actually, they have a topic of your baby in 3D, a new ultrasound that you see baby before it's born. And the headline, parental smoking linked to depression and anxiety in children. Parents who smoke not only risk making themselves sick, they could be making their children depressed, anxious, or aggressive. Cincinnati scientists who studied 225 children ages 5 to 11 found those with the highest levels of exposure to tobacco smoke had more behavioral problems such as fidgeting, acting out, and not paying attention in school. Well, see, my parents didn't smoke, but I think I had all three of those. And there was a clear dose response effect. The bigger the exposure, the bigger the problems. However, children breathing in even low levels of cigarette smoke had behavioral issues as well. Two Mounties ordered to resign for misconduct. The RCMP finds one guilty of rape, the other of attempted fraud. This is a Vancouver Sun exclusive. Two BC Mounties were ordered to resign over the past year after disciplinary panels found them guilty of several severe misconduct, rape in one case and attempted fraud in another, according to documents obtained by the Vancouver Sun.
I have a feeling some bad stuff is about to go down.
Absolutely. And also they have a Hell's Angel charge after a loaded gun seized at airport. Yeah, why are these people trying to get these weapons into the planes? I mean, this is crazy. It says a member of the White Rock chapter of the Hell's Angels is facing several weapons charges after allegedly trying to board a flight to Edmonton with his fully loaded semi-automatic handgun in his carry-on luggage. Billy Roy Linrup, a 41-year-old Langley resident, was arrested Friday evening in the domestic departures area of Vancouver International Airport and later charged with possession of an unlicensed firearm, possession of a prohibited firearm, and carrying a concealed weapon. He's going away for a while. And then below, there he goes, the plane. He missed his plane. You know, unbelievable. Common sense. I mean, you know. province to give BC's troubled ERs a $7 million boost. The British Columbia government will put $7 million into easing problems into emergency rooms following a series of Vancouver Sun stories documenting growing outrage by lower mainland doctors about the conditions they say threaten patients' health and lives. Olympic planning seeks $510 million to put Canadians on podium. The Canadian Olympic Committee is proposing an ambitious five-year, $531 million Summer Olympics funding program that would seek to put Canada in the top 15 for medals at the 2008 Summer Games and the top 10 by 2012.
Does that
suck? Yeah. So they're putting some money in there in those Olympics, so good for them. Yeah. As I said, I'm glad we didn't win all those medals, a whole bunch of medals this time. We end up number one. Now, for the sake of world harmony, let some other countries win the most medals for crying out loud, please. And this next one is from the Billings, Montana Gazette. Something here about Meatmaster, meat and poultry palace owner. What is that? Gary Pollock never tires of steak. So, and there was a meat and poultry palace. And is that like the
You are a meathead.
There you go. I wonder if that's like the Imperial Palace here in Vegas. Peaks to prairie athletes battle elements and each other. 28th annual event adds new twists with duathlon. Duathlon. There you go. Greg Culp began competing in the annual Peaks to Prairie race in 1980. But he's been an avid kayaker since the mid-1970s. That's why it should come up, no surprise, blah, blah, blah. So I see two things in one. Healthcare talk draws division. Three of five U.S. Senate candidates say they favor single-payer universal system. Rebels reject draft Darfur peace plan. Katrina forces the merger of families with mixed results. And that's about it from them. And this next one is from Memphis, from the Commercial Appeal. Life goes on at the polls. Ernest Beatty, remains eligible to vote since the year he died in 1954. Wow. Zed Beatty can't understand why his father's name is still in the election rolls. Sounds like an old Chicago trick to me. I said something about it the last two or three times, and I did nothing about it. Whenever Zed Beatty signs in to vote on election day, he sees his father's name in the poll book and is reminded yet again of his tragic death. Thanksgiving Day when Beatty raced his dad to the hospital, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, his father apparently is still on the doles there, the rolls, to is a registered voter apparently. So
holy cow! Yes.
Register him from the grave, all voting from the cemeteries. Blogs on the right, blogs get a special end run. Memphis native argues campaign finance law should apply there too. For the blogs, I guess, to Carol C. Dar, a University of Memphis trained lawyer, former Democratic National Committee General Counsel, blah, 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 is under attack in the blogosphere. She's taken a decidedly unpopular but prophetic position on the hottest new issue at the intersection of big money, politics, and a free press. Should partisan bloggers be considered journalists and be exempt from all campaign finance regulations? And the bottom, we talk about rally for Darfur. So Darfur is still percolating out there. And this next one's also from Vancouver, Canada. From Sunday, from the province, 11 charge an eagle massacre. Investigations make their move following last year's discovery of at least 48 mutilated bald eagle carcasses, possibly for black market use. I got a picture there of. There you go. Poor bald eagles. Now, didn't we just spend all these years rehabbing the bald eagle population? Weren't they on the endangered list? And we spent all this money repopulating them. Anyway, there's a picture on the right. Conservation officer Terry Moroniak holds a bustle made of eagle feathers used in native ceremonies as the Conservation Service announces charges. So I'm wondering if these are one of the carcasses that were killed. I don't know. Accuser's dad wants to say sorry. Father of the accused in the murder of a popular gift shop employee in Campbell River says he plans to apologize for the death. Restaurant robber shoots, kills diner. Survivors tell of customer's death while trying to stop robbery. Suspicion grows that string of robberies may be linked. So that's from Vancouver. Very good. Carlsbad, California. Today's local news. Immigrants plan Monday boycott. This is from Sunday. Vibrant colors. Ocean High gym name for local hero. Wally Malafua was school's first Polynesian teacher. After the death of his father, Casey said one of the worst things was knowing that his children would never have the opportunity to meet his hero. Now that the Oceanside High School gymnasium bears his father's name, his children will always have something to make him smile. There you go. There's a picture of the son crying. Carlsbad opens a Hidden Valley Community Park. Move on from there. And then we have the Abilene Reporter News from Sunday. Damage from Storm Heavy in Gainesville. And also they talk about They Walk for Children. More than 400 take part in Global Night commute to raise awareness. And let's see. Also, we had Sunday in the Eagle from Wichita, Kansas, about a food fight. Dillon's is still on top, but Walmart's no underdog. They have the comparing the prices of some of the things at Walmart versus Dillon's in Wichita. They have the gallon of milk is $2.92 at Walmart, where it's $2.99 at Dillon's. $2.50 for a sack of Oreos, and then at Dillon's it's $1.88. At Walmart, it's for a 12-pack of Coke, it's $2.66. Well, at Dillon's, it's $3.77.
Holy
cow!
There
you go. 1 pound of pork chops, loin cut, $3.16 at Walmart. Well, it's $3.39 a pound over at Dillon's. And total for 29 items at Walmart, $65.23. Well, at Dillon's, it's $76.96. So I don't know where I'll be shopping.
Spare me your sixth-grade Michael Moore logic.
And a model preschool, it says state could copy Oakland Center. Wichitan drafted in first round. How about Cameron Wimbley tears up after hearing from the Cleveland Browns on Saturday. Wimbley is the third Wichitan to be a first round NFL pick. So I think our guest is online, huh? Bring him on. Okay, one more, two more. We'll bring him on. And then we have this from the Jackson Sun. This one's from. Where are we here? Jackson Sun has the special section recovery from this month's storms. 3 years after tornadoes hit East Jackson, it's still a case of grassroots recovery. Neighborhoods rebuilt, but scars remain from the 03 storms. And this is from Jackson, Tennessee. Gibson County sheriff's candidates tout experience. And they have a picture on the right of a March for Invisible Children. The Invisible Children is a nonprofit organization dedicated to bringing awareness to the plight of children in war-torn parts of Africa. And then we have the Ventura County Sun on Saturday. Talk about the UN agency is critical of Iran, and the UN Security Council says that Iran has persisted with its nuclear program and has continued to defy the UN Security Council. There you go. I think we're starting up with the Iran now. UN cuts refugees' rations in Darfur, another Darfur story. And an Army reservist sues to get out. Brad Schwan went to the U.S. Military Academy because he thought the quality education service to his country would make solid building blocks for his future. He never thought he might serve the better part of his life in the Army. Now, nearly a year after he says his eight-year commitment to the Army expired, the Simi Valley captain is facing the prospect of serving for an indefinite term. Because he can be held during the pleasure of the present. What the hell? Can't be held during the that doesn't sound very good. Can't be held during the pleasure of the present. Whatever. That's what the Ventura County Star says. According to documents in the case of Bradley E. Schwan versus Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State et al. So it's and also at the bottom about the Mexico may legalize possession of small amounts of some drugs. And then we have the morning news from the Fayetteville.
Could we get rid of all the Mexicans?
No. The morning news from Fayetteville says pandemic flu worries officials. And they're talking about that in the news here in Vegas before I left to come here. And also a former teacher not indicted in wife's death. A teacher, a grand jury in Louisiana declined to return an indictment against a former Prairie Grove teacher in connection with his wife's death last year.
Holy cow!
And take back the night. So, but I think we're ready for Ken, huh? Bring him on. And are joined by Ken Pullman of the Spokesman Review. Sir, are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you write for the paper in Spokane, Washington. I got it right, right?
That's right.
You
not
sent me
Spokane.
Yeah. No, I knew it because it's amazing how people get some of these cities wrong. I'm from Chicago, and I call it Chicago like it's supposed to be called. And you get other people, I work at one of the hotels on the Strip, and they Chicago, or they murder the name. It drives people nuts. It must drive everybody from there nuts when they hear that your city getting misnamed all the time, huh?
It's a little bit of a pet peeve. We made some national news with our investigation of the mayor last year, and a bunch of stations called us Spokane, and it just grates on people's nerves.
Now, what was the big news of the mayor? What did he do? Oh, was that the one involved with the scandal?
Yeah, this was it was about a 2 or 3 year long investigation, and the mayor was allegedly using his office to garner dates with young teenage boys, 18-year-olds, and he was recalled by the voters in December as a result of that investigation.
Really, so he's out of office now, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Last I recall, he was fighting this, right? He's going to run again or something. Is that right? Or
well, he's alluded to some political ambitions in the future, and we really don't know what those are going to be. He's also threatened to sue the newspaper for the investigation, and of course we'll cross that bridge if it happens to be thrown in front of us.
Really? Now, what do you do for the paper?
I am an online producer. Essentially, I am the news editor for the website, mm-hmm. for spokesmanreview.com.
And what's the big news in my new little gimmick here is with the going through the headlines. What's the big news in the paper today?
Well, our lead story this morning, we had a case in a rural county out here in northeastern Washington. It's a couple years old. This was a 7-year-old boy who was in foster care. Who died in January of 2005. His name was Tyler DeLeon. And he, at the time of his autopsy, weighed 28 pounds. He died of dehydration. And there has been speculation whether some abuse on behalf of the foster mother contributed to his death. What happened over the weekend was late Friday, the prosecutor up there filed charges alleging mistreatment of a different boy, not the one who died, but an 8-year-old, alleging that she limited the food and fluid intake of this 8-year-old who had, quote, marked retardation in height and weight, but thrived after leaving the foster home. So it's kind of an interesting wrinkle in the story, and it's still developing. We're not sure exactly what to make.
Amazing. So the kid weighed how much when he died? 28 pounds?
28 pounds.
At 8 years old. Wow. Yep. That's... it's my own opinion, but it's not neglect, and I'm Kermit the Frog. I mean, it's pretty common sense. I mean, you would think.
Yeah, well, I'll let you go ahead and make that speculation.
The lawsuits could be directed to now.
Yeah.
And then also, because I actually print out the headlines here, they have about the immigrant protests play up there.
Well, we didn't have any events here locally. In fact, there was the closest event was planned for Moscow, Idaho, which is a university town about an hour and a half from here, and nobody showed up, including the organizer. Now, further west and south, in Walla Walla and the Tri-Cities areas, there's a much larger Hispanic population, and so they had some events down there. But in our immediate community, there's only been one march. That was a couple weeks ago, and we had maybe 150 people or so.
Wow.
Do a demonstration at the federal courthouse.
Huh. So no big impact from the protest. Well, I guess it's more of a California and the border states issue, I guess. Well, I don't know. Chicago had some massive protests as well.
Yeah, it really depends on demographics. We don't have a huge Hispanic population here. We do have a lot of Russian immigrants, interestingly, but that weren't involved with this particular issue.
Mm. Now we're Spokane, Washington. Now we're give away a little geography lesson. Now where is it? That's kind of on the border.
We are about 120 miles south of Canada and about 10 miles west of Idaho. So we're right on the eastern edge of Washington State.
Okay. Now does your paper ever address the border issue from the other perspective, from Canada into the United States?
Well, when you're talking about the Canadian border, it's the larger issue is drug smuggling, and we have had several stories dealing with some of the more creative methods that people employ to get marijuana from British Columbia into the United States. And it's essentially the trade is people coming up to this area and trading cocaine in Canada for marijuana to bring back to the States to distribute. So that's really, as far as our border issues, that's the number one concern.
Now, that's a big issue with drugs coming in. Now, are there a lot of crime associated with the drugs coming in, or is it just the transport of the drugs?
Well, I'm not too terribly familiar with the issue. I mean, we do have, I think, like most cities, somewhat of an elevated, you know, property crimes problem to dealing with crystal meth in our city, but that's, I think, fairly typical for cities our size nationwide at this time.
Yeah. Now, give everybody listening a little, I don't know how much of the, you're familiar with the history of the paper, but it's a relatively old paper, correct?
It's a very old, I believe about 115 years old.
Wow.
It's a family-owned paper, and has been for its entire existence, and we just learned at a staff meeting today that the family, the Coles family, who owns this paper, has committed to maintaining ownership of the paper despite all of the shuffling that's been going on in the industry lately, which is, to me personally, I find reassuring. I like working for an independent company better than a big corporation.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously advantages and disadvantages to both.
Yeah, so it's a family-owned paper. Yeah, because not too many of those left. I mean, of course, you had the big McClatchy. Was it Knight Ridder bought the McClatchy papers and then they're selling them off now?
Yeah, other way around, actually. McClatchy bought Knight Ridder.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, they're selling off the papers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then now a little background about yourself.
Well, I'm actually relatively new to the industry. I came in mid-career. I went to a graduate program at the University of Oregon where I studied journalism. Came up here to work as a copy editor actually about 2.5 years ago, and just over a year ago was promoted to the online department. Relatively new position. Like most newspapers, we're actually kind of ahead of the curve as far as online news goes, and the position I'm in is essentially sort of the linchpin between the website and the newsroom. I'm responsible for coordinating breaking news content and multimedia content and that sort of thing.
Very good. And I was also on the blog, and then you talk about there's every morning there's an editorial meeting where you pretty much put in the blog what happened at this editorial meeting, which is fascinating.
Yeah, what I do, it's the blog is called The Daily Briefing, and it was originally, we have two news meetings each day, one at 10 a.m. and one at 4:30. The 10 a.m. is essentially a critique of the previous day's paper and a look forward to the day ahead, and then at 4:30 we sort of lock down the lineup for the next day's paper. Due to time constraints, I pretty much just deal with the morning meeting because that's when the issues of news judgment and the things that would be of most interest to our readers tend to come up.
Hmm. Now, and with the getting back to the paper itself, now, do the major national issues play well? You know, do you notice, I don't know how you are up with the circulation numbers, but I mean, do you notice when there's a big national story that the papers sell better, or is it more local stories?
Well, we're pretty much subscription based. So there's rarely any significant bump in single copy sales on any given story. Hmm. We just redesigned the paper, and we're in a way to sort of stay competitive. We're reemphasizing local news, and so we do still have the national coverage inside the A section, but on the front page you'll see primarily local stories. That's our stock in trade.
Yeah.
Usually the wire stories, the national wire stories. Good percentage of our readers have already read that news either online or on CNN the day before, and so it's old news by the time the printed newspaper lands on their doorstep.
Yeah,
so we de-emphasize that coverage.
Yeah, very good. I mean, it's one thing I say. I said in an email when I grew up in Chicago, and my grandfather used to take me to the drugstore when I was a kid, and we used to get the Tribune, the Sun Times, and back then it was the Daily News. And when they folded, we went up getting the Southtown, and we'd read them all in the car. And then, he quizzed me about the stories and everything else, but you don't see it anymore. People don't, it amazes me. I mean, I work in one of the casinos, and, people, younger, I'm 39, but people younger, they don't read the papers. It's like, you got to read, what's going on in the world.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we're emphasizing our online coverage, because the studies are showing that younger readers, 18 to 25, that grew up with the Internet, tend to turn to the Internet more for news. Mm-hmm. And the demand for local news on the Internet, as they become older and have greater stakes in their community, they still prefer to get their news online, but they have more interest in local coverage. And so that's one of the reasons we're really aggressive with our online coverage just to capture that audience and keep them interested in our journalism.
Yeah. Now, do you see like any competition between the print paper and the online paper? Is there any kind of you know what I mean?
Not at all. No. We try as hard as we can to sort of make one enhance the other. For instance, if we have a breaking news story during the day, we'll give it, and we post it online, we'll give it what's called a first day lead. You know, so-and-so was sentenced to 20 years in prison today. And then for the print edition, then the reporter will give it more of a second day treatment, kind of a follow-up. And so people will still get the news, but it doesn't feel a day old. Mm-hmm. They focus on something else interesting about the story as their lead sequence. So we're always looking for ways to sort of, and then from the print newspaper, then the website serves as a place to post documents relative to a story, multimedia enhancements, and things like that. So each enhances the other. We don't really see it as a competition between the two.
Very good, very good. Yeah, because I talk about the local Vegas paper, the Review Journal, and it's sad in a town this large. We only have one paper now, but I mean it's just how they always. The front page is usually some national story, and they stick the local issues in section B. And I keep thinking it should be the other way around. Even in Chicago, they always hit the big local stuff either beneath the fold or in the second local section. You know, but here it's a reverse. It's the national stories first, and the local sections in back. I mean, it's a little odd.
Yeah, we do get some criticism from time to time. There are readers who feel that we should place the news story is based on sort of a grand universal importance scale. And so a day where we'll have a local story, I struggle to think of an example, but even this De Leon case, which is a pretty important story, and something about Iran enriching uranium on the inside, and they'll say, well, why are you saying this story is more important than the other? And that's not necessarily how it works, but there are still people who want things done the way things were done 20 years ago.
Yeah, and then, I like that your blog with the editorial meetings. It's fascinating how they discuss what goes on on the front page, and they already talked about this yesterday or a TV station already talked about it, so they put it further into the paper. It's amazing. I mean, do you find yourself slap the newspapers together?
Well, it is. That's a way of putting it. I mean, there is a lot of time pressure in putting the newspaper out each day, and. These decisions are made, at the times they're made, and it's really easy to Monday morning quarterback, what happens the day before. And that's actually one of the purposes of the meetings we have in the morning, is to look back and look at the things we could have done better and the things that we did really well and learn from those and move on. And the blog is actually part of three separate blogs that are part of our transparency initiative, which is to bring readers into the newsroom and give them an insight into our process and let them see how things work. The idea is essentially there's not a lot of trust between readers and journalists. Journalists routinely rank pretty low on surveys as far as professions that people really believe in. We tend to rank below car salesmen sometimes. And this is essentially to say, look, we're human beings, we're professionals, we work very hard at our job, but we can make mistakes just like everybody else, and we appreciate when, we can have a conversation about, if someone doesn't like the way we handled something, we can talk about it online, and everybody can sort of read and join in.
Yeah, because actually I'm on the Daily Briefing now, and you have on the top, blowing things up, they start off today's meeting with a screening of Colin Mulvaney's video. Of the boomer shoot marksmanship event, some other story about when it's appropriate to run a photo of a murder victim.
So yeah, that's actually an issue I brought up. We had you may be familiar with the Groney case from North Idaho.
Oh yeah,
we had a photo of Dylan Groney, the young boy who was killed, and the story was dealing with a memorial that's proposed for his elementary school. And so I just raised the question, do we have sort of a policy or standards for when it's appropriate to run those photos? And it's always a judgment call, like everything in newspapers.
Yeah,
so a story like that, it's appropriate when we're talking about a memorial, but a more incremental story about the investigation, it may not be appropriate.
Yeah, does, I don't know if you know this, but does the paper get any calls? People think, there's a sensational headline or, a picture, they really shouldn't have been on the front page, should have been, buried deeper.
Oh, daily. I mean, we get, you know, people look at the newspaper through a variety of lenses. And one interesting situation we had come up, Vice President Dick Cheney was just in town a couple of weeks ago. And we had a photograph, a pretty regrettable photograph that ran on the front page. Now, it was the general rule of thumb is if you're running a mugshot of somebody, you use the most recent photo you can find. Mm-hmm. The photo that ran was unfortunately not a very flattering photo of the vice president.
Uh-oh.
And we received a bunch of criticism and very much warranted. Our editor, Steve Smith, agreed that a different photo should probably have been selected. But people accusing us of, the liberal bias, the vice president is your political enemy, and, you know, what are you hoping to accomplish with this? Well, a couple of days later, we had a series of complaints about the day before the vice president came to town. We had a story on page one on Sunday. The following day on Monday, we had a story on the regional cover, and then the vice president was in town that day, that Monday, and then the following Tuesday, we had another front page story. This reader accused us of deliberately suppressing the vice president's visit to discourage protesters from coming up because the owners of the paper are supposedly in the pockets of the administration. And so the lesson there is you really can't win. You just have to do your job the best you can, and sort of anytime you're covering politics, people are going to come in and accuse you of being slanted one way or the other.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean,
it's pretty unbelievable. But it's if you look at our Ask the Editors blog, which is spokesreview.com/blog/editors, you'll see those questions back to back. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing that they do that. They ask the editors, why they did this. You don't see any other paper doing that. At least I haven't seen any other paper. I know in Chicago, I know the Tribune. You never are to question the Tribune in Chicago. You know what I'm saying?
Right, and that's the New York Times is doing. I think they actually call it Ask the Editors. They are doing a blog similar to that.
Hmm.
And I personally think it's great. I mean, we don't have anything to hide. I mean, that's the thing. And we may make mistakes from time to time, but there's no question or criticism that we shouldn't feel comfortable dealing with and airing out in public.
Yeah, I just find it fascinating how they decide what to put on the front page and what headline to run with. I mean, I always go back to that Superman movie with Christopher Reeve is in there with what's his name, and he's muddling around with the headlines of the paper with the bomb at the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you saw Superman 2, but it's always it's funny how Paris blown up, Paris exploded, and just who makes that call? The publisher?
It's sort of a collaborative process, and and days when you do have something like the Eiffel Tower being blown up, obviously it makes the decision that much easier. When it becomes difficult is when you don't have an outstanding big breaking story to throw up at the top of the page, and that's when it becomes a bit of a struggle. The afternoon news meeting, the various city editors generally come up with a plan for what stories will go on page one and what stories will go on the region covers. And then the group, the designers, the copy editors, and various other editors sit at the table at 4:30 and we discuss the lineup. And then people are free to make a case one way or the other for one story, going somewhere else. And very often that plan changes, and it sometimes changes later in the night, even after the meeting.
Yeah. Now, how the owners of the paper are feeling about the industry itself? I mean, you hear stories, the papers are folding up and they're floundering. Then you hear other things, they're making more money than they ever did before. I mean, it's kind of hard to figure out fact from fiction.
Well, newspapers are very profitable. Mm-hmm. The part of the problem is that the expectations of profitability among investors have increased in the last few years. But I don't have any specific numbers about our newspaper, and I wouldn't probably be at liberty to give them out even if I did, but we're in the same boat as most newspapers. The right now we're chugging along just fine, but the future doesn't look good. Print circulation declines and online circulation increases. However, the vast majority of our revenue, like most newspapers, comes from the print product. It's about 95% to 5% is the industry standard as far as revenue coming from print versus the internet. So you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that those curves crossing and going in opposite directions spells very bad news for the newspaper. But the word we got today from our editor after meeting with the family was they consider this first and foremost it's a family business, and like most family businesses, you don't want to think lightly about parting with it. So now how they see the financial future, your guess is as good as mine. I don't know anything about that.
Actually, you got a question from the chat room about the, I guess somebody's on the website. They don't see any kind of a gas price watch thing on the front page of the paper. It's actually good. Yeah, a lot of these newspapers, I know here locally, they kind of, you know, pander to that. Oh, I have the gas gauge on there. I mean,
are they talking about the website or the print newspaper?
The print newspaper.
Yeah, gathering that information and gathering it reliably, I don't know if that's ever even come up. My personal view is the most reliable information we would be able to get would be the AAA average. And I don't know what good it does to devote space to reporting what people kind of already know anyway. If it goes up 3 cents or goes down 4 cents, you know that driving by the gas pumps. Now, there is I forget what it's called. It's like Gas Buddy, where people report prices, and it's sort of a user-fed website. We do have a link to that on our homepage, but of course that you've got to take with a grain of salt also.
Yeah, I mean, I have the Monday front page of the paper, and there's no... I like that because you have something that's different. You know, people, you turn on TV and find what the price of gas is, or go on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, and then I like the layout. So it's a new layout? They just started this layout of the paper?
Yeah, I forget. It's only been a couple months ago we just rolled this out. We went to a narrower size. We were one of the last holdouts on the wider width paper that I think the New York Times is still, and I don't remember the exact measurements, but we cut down to save newsprint and cut our production costs.
Yeah, it's very nice because it's kind of got a internet kind of feel to it. Looking at on the side, you got the afternoon weather, and you got the Tuesdays, the Orchid Dreams, and the World, and you got the story about the military blogs. So is that they're trying to make it look more smooth, like it's a like a website?
Well, yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's a lot of work went in. We brought in we borrowed a consultant actually from Knight Ridder, a guy named Matt Mansfield, who works out of San Jose, and there was a very long involved process. We've had a lot of focus groups with readers. In deciding on a new design for the paper, and it's navigability is navigability. What you want to do is make it real easy for time-crunched readers at a glance to get an idea of what's going on. You can unfortunately no longer expect someone to devote 45 minutes to an hour each morning to read your paper. Sometimes they only have 5 or 10.
Yeah, that's really too bad. I mean, it just like I said, the USA Today's kind of got that going with the side things going and everything. It just it's really too bad people don't take more time. There's more news than just what's on CNN or Fox. You should pick up your local paper. And you might learn a thing or two what's going on around the corner. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. But and at the same time though, it's better than it's better to keep those readers and have them only reading a portion of it than having them reading nothing at all.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, better little than have them doing nothing, but not reading the paper at all, correct?
Right, right.
Yeah. And then any big stories coming up tomorrow in the paper before we let you go?
Well, we got a story that we just posted up on our website earlier today, and I haven't had a chance to read it. I can give you the lead. A judge in a county over on the west side of the state, over by Seattle, has struck down $85 million in taxes on liquor and extended warranties that were included in a part of a budget program last year. They said that the judge said the state exceeded the state spending cap by $70 million, and so he invalidated those two portions of the tax law. So I anticipate that's going to be on our front page tomorrow morning.
Really? Now, is that expected to be a big hot button issue?
It's hard to tell. I don't follow that beat closely enough to really speculate on that. But we'll see how it plays out, I guess.
That'd be interesting. Now, do you have a personal blog, or do you want to give out the blog address again?
I don't write anything personally, but the Daily Briefing blog, if people want to check it out. Sometimes it gets actually pretty dull. It gets pretty inside baseball, but sometimes we have a pretty hot topic that's interesting to read about. But it's spokesmanreview.com/blogs/briefing, and you'll find links to all of our other transparency blogs there. And if there are any newspaper folks out there that want to rip those ideas off, why they're there, yeah. feel free to.
Yeah, you should copyright them. Yeah, I know how the newspaper business is in Chicago. They steal ideas from one another all the time, you know?
Yeah, well, I think in this case, I think that's a positive thing. I mean, anything that we can do to make readers feel better about journalism and journalists, then great. I mean, what people, there's a lot of mistrust, but like I said earlier in the show, I'm sort of a newcomer to the industry. Mm-hmm. I come in with somewhat of an outsider's perspective, and I've never met or worked with a group of people that is more concerned about getting it right and more concerned about doing right by their community than the people in our newsroom, and I expect that to be true of most newspapers. So anything we can do to get people to realize that is a positive thing, and I would encourage newspapers to explore those options.
Well, very good, Kemi. Thank you for being on the program. You're an excellent spokesman for the paper. They should be proud to have you.
All right. Well, thanks. It was my pleasure, Sean.
Thank you very much. Have a good night, sir. Thank you. Bye. And it was Ken Pullman, the online producer for the Spokesman Review newspaper in Spokane, Washington, or as we say in Chicago, Spokane, Washington. So that was very interesting. So it kind of plays in with the newfangled headline version of the program. And we'll be taking a break in a moment for the affiliates along the way to sell their products, huh? And then in the second hour, we'll be back with Michael J.W. Stickings of the reaction.blogspot.com with our political discussion. And then ending the program will be our Doctor Who review segment with Invincor. We'll be here, a new contributor. That'll be interesting. Everybody's got to have a name, Invincor. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. I'm Sean O'Mac. This is Subject to Discussion live on LVRocks.com.
About Jack and Diane, two American kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star, Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between the knees. Jackie say, hey Diane, let's run off behind the shady trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, let me do what I please. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone to walk on. Jackie sits back, flexes thoughts for the moment, scratches his head and does his best James Dean. Well, then there and Diane gotta run off to city. Diane says, baby, you ain't missing nothing. But Jackie say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone. Oh yeah, I say life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone. Long after the three. living is gone. Oh yeah, they say life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. A little ditty about Jack and Diane, two American kids doing best they can.
Originating from Las Vegas, Nevada, you're listening to LV Rocks. Noise from Vegas.
And welcome back to the second hour of Subject to Discussion. I'm Sean O'Mac, Sean Daly. You can call me anything you want. Just do not call me late for dinner. And once again, it's Tuesday night in Las Vegas. It's Subject to Discussion time, live at LVRocks.com and also part of the AntiRadio.net family of podcasts, as well as the Meeker Broadcasting. Thank you very much, everybody listening to the podcast. Hello. Thank you. And now we'll be joined by Michael J.W. Stickings of the Reaction Blog. There he goes. And Michael J.W. Stickings, are you there, sir?
Hey, Sean.
Look at that.
That's quite the fanfare.
Oh, you hear it this week. You can hear it.
I feel like royalty.
Yeah, that's our patriotic music.
It really is.
Oh, we turned it up a little bit.
Now, could you do that in Spanish for me, and then maybe I'd be impressed.
I can't do it in Spanish. I'm sorry. Hola, no, hola, hola.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, what do you think of that killer first segment there? That went over well. I don't know.
I like the format. I like the new format.
Really? I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's a little different. So we'll see what happens. And, of course, Michael J.W. Stickings is from thereaction.blogspot.com and also the John Edwards One America Committee blog. What's going on over there in the One America Committee blog there? He's been getting a lot of press lately.
Yeah, he's doing, anyone can head over there. A lot of it is dedicated to what he is up to. He's just getting his message out, the Two Americas message. Those who paid attention to him during the campaign in 2004 will be quite familiar with it. But I mean, I think it's a message that still resonates, obviously. Mm-hmm. For all the talk about, the war on terror and so forth, and even for all the talk of a strong economy right now, I don't know about you, but it seems to me that the middle class isn't feeling it.
Yeah, I've said that for ages. The economy's going so well. How come everybody, Americans, moan and complain about the $3 gas price, but still to go up, I forget 60 cents in 2 weeks is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're an Exxon shareholder, or better yet, an Exxon executive.
There you go.
You're certainly feeling the pinch here. We of course pay for our gas in liters up here in Canada. But I mean, the cost has skyrocketed as well, and every day there just seem to be such ridiculous fluctuations. We tend to blame it on the oil companies too up here. But no, it's a serious issue. And if the president of the United States, who is obviously an oil man himself, can't get this under control, you wonder what's going on.
Yeah, well, everybody keeps saying, why can't he get the oil executives up to the Oval Office and kind of, like they say, jawbone them, get them to, drop the prices? I mean, I don't know. He's too busy up there at the correspondence dinner with his lookalike, making jokes and stuff to getting down to the serious business here, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not terribly familiar with the inner workings of the oil industry, so I'm not sure, you know, what Bush would accomplish if he got the oil executives up there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, as an oil man who is very much concerned with oil profits, you know, I'm sure his buddies in the oil industry would tell him that everything is okay right now. I forget what kind of package the chairman of Exxon got, but I mean, it was ridiculously high.
$400 million.
Yeah, something ridiculous. So, you know, I mean, if that's the kind of system you want, then you're going to have these gas prices. And, you know, of course, if Bush goes ahead with some kind of strike on Iran, we could see yet another spike. I'm not sure what the ceiling is to this.
I don't know.
But I mean, clearly, you know, oil prices are not at their highest levels right now, and any sort of anything new coming out of the Middle East could really upset that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just anything happens over there. I mean, if Israel decides to take out some of those nuclear plants in Iran, you know, they'll shoot up the price of oil, huh?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
And then somebody said they're considering a blockade of Iran. Probably the American military, but I mean, some of this stuff. I don't know, why can't we just sit down with these people and then hash this stuff out with them?
Yeah. No, it's extremely extremely tough situation over there. More and more, at least in terms of the rhetoric, at least in terms of what is out there in the newspapers and the magazines, seems to be warning against any kind of military option with regards to Iran. James Fallows, the star correspondent for The Atlantic, has a piece in the Atlantic that's out on the racks right now that, you know, he wargamed the Iranian situation in 2004 with some military experts, and they all concluded that any kind of military strike could be disastrous.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking in terms of oil prices here and gas prices, and Americans would likely feel it at the pump, but I mean, you know, you're talking about potentially some kind of Iranian response, and not necessarily a conventional response, but I mean a terrorist or quasi-terrorist attack on Israel. You just imagine what Tehran would do to try to disturb the situation in Iraq, for example. The Shia, you know, generally speaking, the Shia in Iraq haven't simply towed the Iranian line. And you know that could happen, of course, if the U.S. struck next door. You know, and plus, I mean, American interests around the world would be threatened.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this would be seen as a you know, yet another strike on a Muslim country, and you know, it would be yet another rallying cry for Al Qaeda and every other terrorist organization and would-be terrorist organization out there. I don't see how this would do us any good.
No, not at all.
And yet, the U.S. has its hands tied because it is in Iraq. I don't know. I don't really see the way out. I mean, I keep saying that too on my blog. I write quite a bit about Iran.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see them talk. I think there is the possibility that in fact all this bluster is simply for domestic consumption, and that, you know, there could possibly be some sort of backroom deal, some sort of negotiation to contain Iran's nuclear program. But, you know, whether or not the U.S. decides to sit down at the same table with the Iranians and begin serious negotiations, I don't know.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, of course, this is the 30-year anniversary of Bush's Mission Accomplished speech as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mission Unaccomplished, yeah. I think, is really where we are. It's just so humorous in a way. I mean, and not humorous in terms of the significant loss of American life after Mission Accomplished.
Yeah.
But just so humorous to think back to those days when Bush was still fairly popular. Where, I mean, I don't know what you were doing during the Iraq War, but I mean, I was staying up late, getting up early, watching all of this on TV, completely taken by these, you know, embedded reporters. It was cool in a way, wasn't it? I mean, it was.
Yeah.
Wow, look at the U.S., the shock and awe campaign, the, you know, rolling into Baghdad. This seems great. Surely they've planned things. I was a supporter of the war at the beginning. You know, and to think back now with Bush at 32% in the approval rating, to think back to him in that you know, flight jacket, standing on an aircraft carrier.
Unbelievable. And, you know, landing at, you know, on a fighter jet. And then you hear the stories come out later that they had to turn the ship around or something because it was coming in too early and the sun would be in the wrong spot or wherever it was. They had
to
turn.
The seamen and sea women were standing on the deck for what seemed like hours waiting for him to arrive.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And then,
it's funny how things can change in a few years.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how all this has turned around. And then what's your take on the immigration issue we had yesterday? I mean, the rallies were all over the country. I went through it in the headlines. Just, it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, tell me first. I mean, you know, because we don't have, I mean, you know, Canada is just like the United States, mm-hmm. is an immigrant nation, certainly, although we don't have the same issue with illegal or undocumented immigration. Did you feel the effects of any kind of walkout yesterday?
I'm sorry, I lost you. What was it? I'm sorry.
Did you feel the effects of the walkout yesterday?
At work here in Las Vegas, yes, I did. I have to say, in my department, yeah, we were down to six staff members. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, Vegas is heavy on the, you know, just it's the town we're in. I mean, we're service industry. Of course, you're going to have more, you know, the not just Mexicans, but you get Guatemalans, you get, you know, people from all over. But I mean, it just. And they did their best to try and stem that, but it just, you know, and they had this rally at 6 o'clock last night for those who you know, they had this one. If you want to walk out at the beginning of the day, you can, after you get off work, you can go join this rally on the Strip. Well, I mean, the hotels are open 24 hours, so you had people actually walk off and go to this 6 o'clock p.m. rally. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so. I think we discussed this a couple of weeks ago. I'm extremely sympathetic to the plight of undocumented immigrants in the United States. I think the vast majority of them are simply trying to make a better life for themselves. And, you know, the United States has long fashioned itself to be sort of the beacon upon the hill and to be a land of, sorry for the cliches, but, you know, the land of hope and opportunity. And, you know, one can hardly fault them for essentially risking their lives, risking their families' lives, in some cases abandoning their families, leaving them behind, mm-hmm. to try to come into this country. And let's face it, many of them are doing jobs that none of us would want to do. Our economy depends upon them significantly. And I think that was the message, hopefully, that everyone was able to take away from yesterday, that, you know, these people may be undocumented, they may be quote-unquote illegal, but look what they contribute to our society, and look at what would happen to society if they were simply all deported or imprisoned or, you know, whatever solution the far right wing has for this problem. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily to excuse illegal immigration. No. I think something needs to be done. There needs to be some kind of compromise found, but I think it's important that they become visible, because, you know, so many of them are simply invisible. And
like I said last week, I said last few weeks, I think this is a hemispheric issue. I think if we're going to stop, you know, these people coming in, you know, over the border in Mexico, you know, it starts in South America, then they come through and over the border, you know, from Mexico over into the United States. I mean, they need to address the economic factors down there. I mean, I understand why, you know, if you know, hopefully we'll make this move to more ethanol-based cars. Brazil has all these ethanol plants, you know, already. I said, why don't we work with them to produce ethanol, you know, help them economically and bring that ethanol here into the United States, you know?
I don't know. That's certainly true. It is maybe more difficult for us in Canada to see it this way, but it is very much a hemisphere. I think that's very well put. It is a hemispheric mm-hmm. issue. And, you know, of course, one of the problems is that the United States is on such a different economic plane from these South American countries, even the more developed ones like Argentina and Brazil. I'm not sure how you'll stop immigrants from trying to get into the country, or mm-hmm. I should say how you'll stop citizens of these other countries from trying to get in. All I know is, you know, building a chain link fence across the U.S.-Mexico border, as the Minutemen were trying to do over the weekend,
mm-hmm.
Isn't really the kind of solution that works. I don't see how that helps.
Yeah, well, you build a 10-foot high fence, they'll bring out an 11-foot ladder, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody made a joke, I forget who it was. Saturday Night Live was making fun of Bill Riley. And he doesn't want a 700-mile fence. He wanted a 700-mile high fence, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only so much. Like I said, if we can somehow help, if people are in South and Central America and Mexico are having a good living and a good life, they'd be less likely to want to come to the United States. You know, if they have money and because I know in Mexico the rich and the poor, the divide is even worse than it is here in the United States.
That's true.
Yeah.
Although I will say this, I'm extremely sympathetic towards those who are already in the country. Many of them are living as Americans, for all intents and purposes, contribute a great deal to the economy. Have children that are in the schools and certainly shouldn't be uprooted.
Yeah, yeah.
Something does need to be done to stop the flow of human labor into the United States. And I mean, it's interesting to relate this back to John Edwards somewhat. Now I certainly don't speak for John Edwards on immigration. I don't want anyone to think that. But I mean, what are the concerns that someone like John Edwards raises? I mean, you're talking about the lack of jobs, essentially. Jobs aren't there, opportunities aren't there for lower income Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with illegal immigration is that it brings people into the country to do work off the books, and ultimately to take work away from Native Americans, those who are here legally. Who should be doing those jobs, or who at least should have the opportunity to do those jobs.
Mm.
So in a sense, I mean, there is, it's tough, right? Because if you are a liberal person, if you feel strongly that the United States should welcome immigrants, you really, it really has to happen legally. I mean, we really need to find a way to incorporate existing immigrants into the country legally, and then to regulate the flow of immigrants into the country in a much better way.
Exactly. Actually, that's what the economist Bruce and I were talking about before. We can't round these 12 to 20 million people up. I mean, fix those damn borders, and then give them, legalize on them here now, because you can't round up 12 to 20 million people, and if we are government acts, you might as well just do it, get it over with, because the paperwork would be a nightmare, and then have a set strict procedure to become a citizen of the United States.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
But again, the United States can't afford to have, say, 10 million more undocumented
Correct.
Immigrants. So as liberal as I am with regards to the undocumented immigrants who are already in the country, again, something needs to be done to limit the number of new undocumented immigrants in the United States. I'm not sure what that is. Enforcing the laws is a way to start. And simply put, I look at it this way: millions of people. I don't know what the number is, but a lot of people are trying to get into the United States legally. A lot of people would like to live and work in the United States. Illegal immigrants are essentially jumping to the head of the queue.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's a problem. I mean, again, I sympathize with them. Maybe they're coming from terrible places, terrible situations where they have nothing. But what about those people who are in line, who are waiting to get in? Shouldn't they have an opportunity as well?
Hey, this is Con.
True.
Yeah, I'm surprised not one media outlet has. I haven't seen one report or any interviews with anybody that's trying to become a citizen and being outraged about it. I don't know if they're just trying to keep it like undercovers, just so they don't want to. You know what I mean? I mean, there's got to be someone outraged out here that's trying to become a citizen. Probably, I'm sure there's a guy out there that's trying to get his family here for the past 10 years, and he sees these people.
Yeah,
and then he's got to be outraged, but no one's interviewing him.
It's crazy. I know. It's nuts. I mean, you get this poor guy. Some people on the news. Somebody's been here for 20 years, still has not become legal. And then, I mean, I don't know the solution. Who knows? I mean,
just because you border us, just because as far as like geographically, you border us, doesn't make you any more special.
Yeah.
To someone that's from I don't know. There could be someone from the Philippines that's been here for 15 years trying to get his family here, and he or she can't.
Or there may be
a Filipino family that is living in a similar condition to families in Mexico who would love to come to the United States and maybe who have even put in an application to come to the United States.
I don't know. It's an issue that's – I don't think there's going to be a clear-cut winner.
Yeah, that's your next problem.
Yeah.
Whams if they say, well, okay, we'll just – whoever's here, we'll give them amnesty. But then after that, I think you're going to get uproar from the people that have been trying to
–
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, so there, you got to find a happy medium.
Yeah, yeah. It's gonna be something that's not everybody's gonna be happy. I mean, you're gonna, rile up somebody, but I mean, it's gonna be a solution which appeals to both sides. I think. I don't know. I know. Actually, when I talk about Bush's unpopularity, oh boy, he's dropping like a rock in his polls, huh?
Well, yeah. There's even been some debate in the liberal blogosphere about what kind of floor he may have. Will he go even below 30? And I don't know. I mean, if for example he launches some kind of strike against Iran, possibly in the fall before the midterms, if it's seen as some sort of wag the dog situation, it's quite possible that his approval ratings could fall into the 20s. If gas prices continue to soar over the summer, it's possible that his approval ratings could fall. You know, essentially the Bush presidency is over.
Oh, he said stick a fork in him, he's done, right?
It is. I mean he has nothing in the way of a domestic agenda.
No.
In terms of foreign policy, obviously Iraq continues to be one great weight around his neck. As commander-in-chief, he still has immense authority and immense power and could still do something with respect to Iran. You know, but other than that, aside from trying to expand executive authority, executive power by refusing to acknowledge congressional laws and so forth, which the Boston Globe reported on over the weekend, it's over. He's a lame duck even before he should be a lame duck.
Yeah.
And all this shuffling in the White House, I think proves that Karl Rove was not demoted. He has essentially been put in charge of the 2006 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Josh Bolton has the new chief of staff has a 5-point plan to try to resurrect the Bush presidency. But essentially, it's not a 5-point policy plan. It's 5-point PR plan.
Yeah.
And bringing Tony Snow in as to replace McClellan, I think just emphasizes that point.
Yeah, what do you think about that? About bringing Snow in? You know, if everybody in the talk radio industry kind of moves up a spot with him out of the way. But what do you think about that?
Well, I don't. I try not to watch too much Fox News. It is available up here, and I have watched it from time to time. I find it quite sickening. Not least because they'll do some sort of news segment and bring on Michelle Malkin as their analyst, as if this is in any way fair and balanced. Snow seems like a reasonable character. He has criticized the White House in the past. He's a slick, he's a slick commentator. I can't see how he could do any worse than Scott McClellan, who seemed to be a punching bag up there.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, what's Tony Snow going to be defending? I mean, Tony, he may put a nice spin on it. He might put a pretty face on it, and the press corps may at first be taken in by him. But I mean, what is he going to be out there doing? I mean, just spinning the latest spin, and no one believes Bush anymore.
True. I mean,
when you see the latest, the latest pictures coming out of Iraq, and Tony Snow gets up there and saying that things are going well. I think that disconnect will still be obvious to anyone, whether it's McClellan or Snow or anyone else.
Yeah, yeah, it's unbelievable. Well, I think one way to boost Bush's approval or appeal is to crank out a DVD of that Correspondents' Dinner thing there. That was funny as can be. Did you watch that on C-SPAN? Do you have C-SPAN in Canada?
Well, I do have access to it.
Yeah.
My phone line was cutting out there. This is the Colbert thing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, it was funny. It's good with that. And then we had the impersonator up there. I said, well, if he's going to fix his credibility, you better sell this thing on DVD or something. You know?
Yeah. He probably should. I mean, look. The funny thing about Bush is that if you actually go back to the late 90s when he was governor of Texas and even into 2000, I mean, he he was a fairly likable guy, right? I mean, there was a reason he beat Al Gore. And it wasn't just that you know, Gore was stiff and somewhat unappealing, and there didn't seem to be any major issues that divided Gore and Bush. And you know, Bush was sort of that modern, in a way, almost progressive Republican, sort of in his father's tradition. I mean, he speaks Spanish, yeah. Right? I mean, when he was governor of Texas, I mean, he emphasized education. He seemed to be someone who could get along with the quote-unquote common people, and he mm-hmm. had that common touch.
Yeah.
Not sort of Bill Clinton's common touch, but I mean, he had his own version of a common touch.
Yeah, I think Clinton liked being touched, I think, right? Especially by interns, right?
He did, yes, and maybe he used the common touch for that purpose. You know, every time when I think of that, I keep thinking of that image of him and Monica at the rope line, sort of embedded in our culture now. But
hey, I wanted to ask your opinion. Did you hear the Spanish version of the
National Anthem? Yeah, what'd you think of
National Anthem?
Was it Nuestro Himno?
Yeah.
What'd you think of that?
Well, I mean, this connects with what I was just saying about Bush being somewhat self-effacing and being somewhat progressive and being a different sort of Republican, at least back in 2000. Back in 2000, he actually sang the Spanish version of the anthem.
Really?
I encourage your listeners to go check out the Carpetbagger Report, where I was guest blogging over the weekend. It's one of the excellent liberal blogs out there. And Steve Bannon, who writes it, points out today that he has links to all these stories that Bush was singing the anthem and encouraging people to do it in 2000. The State Department, in fact, has versions of the has lyrics to the Spanish version on its website.
Huh.
Spanish versions have been commissioned in the past. This is not a new thing. This is being sort of blown out of proportion, I think, by Republicans who have nothing else there. But
wow, you're just a resource of information. I had no idea.
Yeah, but I think the difference is there's a difference between an American writing in Spanish than. I think there is.
It's very little. I mean, I know.
Yeah, but did you hear
be in English, no matter what. I think the national.
No, I mean, did you hear the new
yeah,
the new one?
Actually, was kind of nice.
Yeah.
No, did you hear the translation?
Oh, no, they changed the words
they
and stuff.
It, yeah.
Yeah.
The guy kind of wrote it back, and I was like, it made really no sense.
What's that noise?
I must admit, I'm a little bit disturbed when the lyrics to the anthem are changed.
Yeah.
But I mean, let's face it, it's the anthem. People change it. I mean, people will change it to whatever they want. I mean, it's not.
And Roseanne just murdered it a few years ago during the baseball game. Remember?
There's a great white American who you know had a really popular TV show. Yeah. She grabbed her crotch while she was singing it. I mean, how is that less offensive than patriotic Spanish-speaking Americans wanting to sing the anthem in their own language? I don't see the problem with it.
No. Well, it's just the media. You got to trump it up. You know, trump it up, and then Lamar Alexander trots out this ceremonial bill there, and they all wrap themselves around that and everything.
Let's have a look at that. Right, that's Lamar Alexander's resolution. Lamar Alexander, who you haven't heard anything from over the past 10 years, right? Suddenly coming out with it.
How many times have you run for president?
Right. I mean, the resolution is co-sponsored by you know the leading, you know, lights of the conservative Senate, which is you know Bill Frist and Mitch McConnell and Ted Stevens of Alaska, that the old crank. I mean, again, this is sort of knee-jerk nativism, and you get people like Michelle Malkin coming out and saying this is our anthem. I mean, this is Michelle Malkin. I mean, she's not, you know. Look at Michelle Malkin. People could say you're not one of us.
Yeah.
I don't say that about her, but I mean people could say that.
Yeah, she's a pretty big mouth too, isn't she?
So this is all just extremely offensive to me. And what exactly is going to happen if you're caught like singing the anthem in Spanish? You'll get a ticket. I don't understand this at all.
So we got other things to worry about than that. I mean,
but flag burning, right? It's the right wing is so desperate that it's going to find any wedge issue it can. Again, whether it's flag burning, whether it's this, whether it's same-sex marriage, same-sex adoption, whatever it happens to be, whatever issues they need this fall, they'll trot out there.
Exactly. Well, Michael, we'll let you go. End of our segment here with you.
Fantastic. Always flies by.
It flies.
Always flies by.
It always flies when we're having a good time talking politics and harping on Bush, right?
Look, I mean, there's so much material, right?
I know. I should get a third hour, right, Con?
Yeah, what are you
going to
do?
No, 2 hours is enough for him. He sits there all day anyway.
Well,
anyway.
Keep up the good fight, Sean.
Yeah, all right. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Take it easy.
All right. Have a good night.
Great. Bye-bye.
And that was Michael J.W. Stickings of thereaction.blogspot.com. And in just a moment, we'll be joined by Invincor of the he'll give us a Doctor Who review and more. Actually, I spoiled it. I was going to pretend it was going to be Koenig Rules and have him come out of the TARDIS as a regenerated Eric Turbo. Oh, well, I shot that all to hell. So much for that scheme. But, oh, well, I mean, all good plans go to waste. And then, actually, I thought the episode with Father's Day was outstanding, 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 outstanding. I was in tears at the end of the episode when Rose there saying goodbye to her father and everything. I was like, oh man, this is, you know, packed a wallop. I didn't think this show after Who is going to get like that. But anyway, before we bring him on, I want to thank everybody for being on the program. And of course, thank you all you for listening to the program live and everybody listening on the podcast and everybody in the chat room. I know I don't thank everybody enough in the chat room. I kind of get wound up with what I'm talking about, but I see everybody. Kick is in there. Rush, Miss M. Rush, GDI. Sam, Lil Buck, of course, Koenig Rules is in there, Invincor, a great coupon, Giorgio, and Ebnetter. And Ebnetter gave me a little news tidbit that the majority of the illegal immigrants in San Francisco, she says, are Irish, no less. Top of the morning to you. So, and then, but anyway, I want to thank Ken from the Spokesman Review newspaper being on, and also, of course, Michael J.W. Stickings. So, and I like that little new format at the headline, so at the I'll work on that a little bit more next week. And like I said, I liked the Father's Day episode completely. It was I just enjoyed it. I thought it was going to be kind of hokey and everything, but it was outstanding. So I think we'll be joined. I think I see the TARDIS in the distance. Battery for that TARDIS, what do you think? And joining us coming out of the TARDIS is Invincor. Are you there, sir?
Hello, Sean. Good evening.
Ah, how was the ride in the TARDIS? You know, I told you it'd be a little cheesy, but...
No, that's perfectly fine.
Ah, how'd
you
like that?
Yes, I am Invincor, but you can call me Steve.
Oh, you revealed your name live. have you revealed your name before?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. I thought we were having a scoop.
Invincor is a very old internet name I've used since probably about 1994. Comes from a Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie.
Absolutely.
Where there was this character who came into the film, and he thought he was going to be the big hero, and he was called Invincor, and he sat down on a rock and turned into stone, and that was it for him.
Now, where are you calling from?
I live in Wisconsin.
Ah, very good. Near Midwestern. I'm from Chicago, so yeah. And of course, Koenig is from Chicago as well. So it's a good Midwestern contingent here. You know. Now, do you have your own website? What's your website address for everybody listening?
My website is called DoctorWhoDVDFact.com. That's spell it all out. It's DoctorWhoDVDFAQ.com.
Okay. And how long have you had your website?
Excuse me, I'm having a little hard time hearing you.
How long have you had your website?
The website has been around several years, and then before that, it existed as a regular internet posting on Usenet before we even had websites.
Really?
Originally, it was about the VHS tapes of the original series, and then that eventually mutated into the DVDs. Hmm. And in fact, I do a little unofficial advising BBC Worldwide Americas on the content of the DVDs, and I help them write some of the little bio material that used to go onto them.
Wow. So you're the expert about Doctor Who, then. I'm glad we had you on, then.
Yes,
huh?
Well, it's nice to be on.
Yeah. Now, actually, somebody else is saying they can't get to your website. Anyway, DoctorWhoDVDFAQ.com, right?
Yeah, that's right.
There's no the in front of it. Just not the Doctor Who, or just DoctorWhoDVDFAQ.com?
That's right.
All right. So let's see if it, I'll try here on my end, see if it comes up. There it is. Yeah, it's up there fine. I see it fine. So anyway, now give everybody down. Doctor Who's been around for what, 40 years?
It started in 1963, November the 23rd, the day after Kennedy was shot.
Ooh.
That's a famous date. That's one reason they went in. When you saw in the first episode, Rose, they showed the Ninth Doctor at the assassination. That was a little in-joke to the fact that the series began the day after that.
Wow. That's a little tidbit there.
Yeah.
Now, how do you think, what do you think, well, I'm sure you're probably getting the new episodes are airing or now of the second series, but what do you think how the new Doctor Who is doing? I think it's fantastic.
He's doing very, very well. If you're talking about David Tennant.
Yes.
Yeah,
no,
he's doing fantastic. The ratings in the UK are just as strong as they were last year, maybe even a little stronger considering.
What about Christopher Eccleston? Yeah, that's who I was referring to, the one that's airing here on Sci-Fi right now. He's outstanding.
Yes, they're both outstanding.
Yeah.
I would have liked Eccleston to have stayed for a longer period of time, but and the reasons why he left, you can get three or four different ones, and they're probably all wrong. The fact is, he's never come out and actually said why he only did the 1 year, and indeed, when the BBC tried to say why he only did the 1 year, he made sure that they corrected themselves and said, oh wait, he didn't really tell us that. We apologize, and he still won't say it. And he's so press shy, I wonder if he ever will.
Yeah, actually I'm on your website now, and very cool. You got the DVD cover on there, very nice, and the inside is actually the TARDIS, like it is on the TV show, huh?
Yes, it is. I've got one of these on my shelf, in fact, because you can already get the Region 1 set out of Canada.
Ah.
Because the CBC in Canada show the entire series last year, very shortly after each episode aired in the UK. And BBC Worldwide Americas didn't want to wait too long to get the DVD set out in Canada. They wanted to do a nearly simultaneous release, and it was originally going to be coming out in November of last year up there to tie in with the same release in the UK, which was also November last year.
Really?
But then they thought, well, hang on, why don't we can't seem to sell the show at the price that we want in America. Let's just do a direct-to-DVD release in both countries at the same time. If we're going to do that, we've got to push it off a little bit. And they originally scheduled a date of February of this year. And then suddenly the Sci-Fi Channel changed their minds or liked the better price that they were offered and decided to pick up the show. But it was already too late to stop the wheels going for Canada. Plus, they wanted to get it, they wanted to get it out before it was too old and moldy on the Canadians' minds.
Yeah.
So they went ahead and did the release in Canada on Valentine's Day.
Huh.
And if anyone wants to jump ahead and see the entire series, they can import it off of something like Amazon Canada. Mm. I believe it's like about $80 U.S.
Wow.
If you do that.
No,
it'll be about $70 when it comes out here, if you get from Amazon.com. The suggested retail price will be $100.
Really?
And that's to protect the U.K. market, because that's one question I get frequently asked is why is the DVD set going to be so much more expensive here than your garden variety DVD sets of TV shows? And that's because the UK market hasn't seen the price erosion in DVD box sets that the American market has. And if they were to price it at a level that's comparable to, say, a Battlestar Galactica or a Lost or something like that, like where you're down the $40-$50 range, then suddenly it becomes cheaper for the British people to import the DVD set and play it on their own sets over there, because they all have multi-region players.
Yeah. Now,
their agreements with retailers in the UK say they're not allowed to do that kind of thing with the pricing, so they've got to keep it at a high level.
Yeah. Actually, the chairman's questioning about the Sci-Fi ratings for Doctor Who's been dropping.
It kind of bottomed out here.
Yeah.
It started at they were getting regularly at 1.6 for the first episode, and then I think it was a 1.4, and then Dalek, I think, bottomed out at 1.17. The Long Game was 1.2 again, and we haven't heard what Father's Day we got yet.
Yeah.
And, of course, those ratings are households. So the actual number of viewers is more than that, because some households have more than one person watching. I believe the for the long game, there were 1.4 million viewers.
Exactly. Well, you said these ratings for these sci-fi shows, I think, are... I don't know. I think more people are watching Galactica than the
Nielsen. That is true, but keep in mind that these episodes are a year old.
Yeah.
A lot of people have already seen them over the internet. Maybe they have the DVD set I was just talking about.
True.
And also, they have nothing else new on at the moment. The only new show on Sci-Fi Fridays right now is Doctor Who, and even those are a year old. They just haven't shown them yet. The Stargates on either side are repeats.
Yeah,
and those are not even showing up in the top 10 shows for Sci-Fi each week. Like, if you look at the rating for for Dalek, we've got the official number on that. That was actually second place for all shows that Sci-Fi had that week.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it just makes sense. Because, I don't know, have you heard anything if they're going to pick up the second season when to air in front of Galactica?
If they get, well, let's. We're not certain yet. I mean, there's rumors out there that's going both ways. It does occur to me that there's a very suspicious-looking hole that Doctor Who would fit very nicely into immediately in July, because July is when the two Stargate series return. And if it would seem to make sense to me to have, if you want to have a three-hour block of programming, we know Galactica's isn't coming back until October,
yeah,
to run the second series of Doctor Who in there, in between the two Stargates.
That
would be
sense.
My guess.
Yeah.
That's what I would do if I were in their position. I know that they have an option to buy the second season already negotiated.
Mm.
Whether or not they're going to exercise it is still up in the air.
Yeah, well, I would imagine. Now, what'd you think of Father's Day? I said before you came out, I thought it was outstanding.
Yes, it is outstanding. And,
yeah. The whole thing with Rose when I go back and see her, you know, the date her father died. And
yes, it's a very good example of the way the writing on the series matured during what the fans tend to call the wilderness years. Now, these are the years when the show wasn't being made on television anymore. This is everything from between 89 to, it's ended in December of 89. From 1990 up until just before the new series, we were in the wilderness period.
Mm-hmm.
And the only new Who material that was coming out, and actually there was a lot of it, were original fiction books and audio plays. And there, the fans really took on the writing themselves and started asking and answering all sorts of questions that had always been in the back of their minds, but the TV producers had never addressed, such as, wouldn't you want to go back in time and meet your father the day he died?
Yeah,
the father you never knew. And Paul Cornell, the writer of Father's Day, really cut his teeth in the novels. He's probably the foremost name of the novel writers.
Yeah.
And all the writers who weren't Russell T. Davies, pretty much, all had experience. Well, Moffat didn't really, but most of them had experience in either the books or the audios or both.
Mm. Well, and then actually, the chat room saying that Alana or Alan saying that the new Doctor Who series. Let me see. The series didn't really get to me until Father's Day. So they said it was a pretty powerful. You know, even Koenig said that's going to grab you. From here on out, it's going to be a wild ride to the end of the first season.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah,
I really think the season really kicked into gear with Dalek.
Dalek, yeah.
That's where they really started to hit their stride. Part of the problem, why it stumbles a little bit at the beginning, I think, especially in the episodes that were shot in what's called the first block. And that was Rose, Aliens of London, and World War III, the episodes 1, 4, and 5. You have to keep in mind that Britain and the BBC, they've never done a show of this size and scale and with this much science fiction in it at a level that looks convincing.
Yeah.
This is the first time they've done this, and when they first started, they didn't know what they were doing, to be blunt. And so there was a lot of stumbling. They wound up doing a lot of reshoots on that first block just to get the episodes done. But once they kind of got that first block under their belts, they really started to pick things up with the second block, which was The End of the World and The Unquiet Dead, and then especially the third, which was Dalek and Father's Day. And from then on, they really, really hit their stride, and the writers turned in fantastic scripts. That's where it always starts, is with the scripts.
Because I mean, it's just it, the especially this episode was so the, you know, the effects were unbelievable. How you know they she froze and she didn't come out in time to see her be with her father when he died. They went back and they're standing there again, and of course she screws up by saving him and all that.
Yeah,
and the effect was unbelievable. It almost looks like you couldn't tell.
I love the Reapers.
Yeah,
they're very good.
Yeah, they came out and then even her running by their first version of them standing there. I mean, wow, it looked like they really were standing there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then it did the whole thing with the church and the Reapers going after the church. I mean, that was amazing as well.
Some great direction there too. Joel Ahern, really the director. He really found some great lighting to use in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Especially there's one shot, and it was nice that for once Sci-Fi put the commercial in the right spot. When they come back from commercial, there's a shot of Rose in the foreground with this blue light on her as she realizes she's just about destroyed the world. The doctor's been apparently killed by a Reaper. And there's a shot of her looking really, really
down,
out of it and sad in the foreground
and
with the stained glass window in the background. It's just fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that shot.
Well, and then they look up into the church and see the Reapers flying on your side of the windows and the
shadows.
That was
nice.
Unbelievable as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. And the whole thing with her father, I mean, it was very dramatic. I mean, you get emotional.
And that was the idea. And it's the kind of thing Paul Cornell specialized in the books that he wrote, and that's why he was assigned this episode.
Yeah.
And I'm very pleased to be able to say that he's coming back in the third season.
Wow.
They're giving him a two-parter to write.
Very good.
No idea yet what that's going to be about. However, I suspect it's going to be much the same sort of a human interest story, because that's what he does.
Yeah, and I liked how they kind of went back and forth between Jackie telling her younger daughter, the daughter a little older, about what happened to her father, and it kind of went back.
I love young Mickey.
Yeah.
The little baby Mickey who comes in and runs and just grabs all the Rose.
that was amazing. And Jackie and the whole thing with her father, how you're sleeping on it. This is a rose, and you name your child after all your girlfriends. I mean, the whole thing, and then the doctor telling Jackie off, I waited a long time to tell you off, liked it. I mean, everybody knows that, it was amazing, the series, but this episode, especially, just drew you in.
And that's one reason that got nominated for a Hugo Award.
Well, absolutely. I hope it wins it.
Yeah, actually, the one that will win it,
what?
If a Doctor Who episode wins the Hugo, it'll be the one that comes next.
Uh-oh.
Because we have a story that I think just almost all the fan polls agree that the story coming next, which is a two-parter, and the first part is called The Empty Child, that this is the one that will win, because this was everyone's favorite.
Really?
This is set during World War II in the London Blitz. And they recreate German air raids very, very convincingly. My jaw hit the floor when I saw the footage that they got of this.
Wow.
And it's also the introduction of a new character named Captain Jack Harkness, I believe Koenig Gruhls has talked to you about.
Yes.
And
spins off next year, right?
Excuse me?
No, he gets spun off into his own series, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. He's going to be taking over Torchwood.
That's a
spin-off series that will... they should have just started shooting it now. I believe Maeve 1 was the day that they were supposed to start.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to air in Britain, I believe October is the date they're shooting for. That'll be a 13-episode series. That will be more adult.
Yeah.
It'll be on after 9 o'clock over there, which is the watershed. After the watershed, they can pretty much do anything they want on ordinary broadcast television. Swearing, violence, nudity, the whole nine yards. I don't expect to see that sort of thing in Torchwood. There will be more sex and violence than you see in ordinary Doctor Who, which is at 7 o'clock and is meant for a family audience. Mm-hmm. And to everyone's astonishment, in Britain, it does get a family audience. It really does draw all demographic ranges and equal numbers of men and women,
which
is totally unlike what something like the Sci-Fi Channel ordinarily gets. I mean, they usually trend male, and that's usually...
Yeah.
The young male demographics, what they shoot for, and that's why every one of their shows is military in nature, and everyone has a rank. And
that's true. Well, like Galactica and the Stargates and all that.
Everyone's commander or lieutenant or private something.
Yeah. Now, Captain Jack. Now he's he's a bisexual. What is he? He's a bisexual.
I'll spoil you a little bit here. You could call him omnisexual because he'll hit on anything.
Uh-oh.
Men, women, robots, you name it.
You're kidding me.
I don't want to tell you exactly what he is because it spoils the plot point. You'll find out by the end of The Empty Child what he is.
Really? Yeah,
what he's up to.
We got enough trouble with the spoilers last week.
He's American, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
He's played by John Barrowman, who was largely raised here, but he's originally from Scotland.
Really? Now is that going to be ready to be aired when? In October in Britain?
Oh, I'm talking about, Torchwood will air in October.
Really?
Jack's debut is this Friday at 9 Central. Nine Eastern on Sci-Fi. That's The Empty Child.
Would be ideal if they air Torchwood on with the new episodes of Battlestar.
Yes, I noticed that too.
Yeah,
it would line up. I went through the calendar one day, marking out, if they did this week and this week, they could do a continuous run of New Doctor Who for 14 weeks, because they have the Christmas one to do too. But Torchwood for another 13 weeks after that. That's 27 weeks. That would take them into the time when Galactica's supposed to come back. And Torchwood's a more adult show.
Yeah.
You could pair them up. However, I don't know if you've seen the news lately. The Sci-Fi is expanding their original programming, and they're going to be adding another night of new stuff Mondays. So they really could put it anywhere. They announced a big slate of a lot of new shows on their website recently.
Dresden Files and all that.
Yeah.
And now I don't know if you may or may not know it, but supposedly I heard that one guy that gets killed by the Reapers is actually Christopher Eccleston's father.
I think you've gotten a story confused.
No?
Here.
Oh, okay, because somebody said, "Oh, that the guy that gets the first guy, the father of the groom, that's actually Eccleston's."
Don't believe his parents are in the profession at all. It wasn't. I think at some point it was either on Father's Day or it might have been during Dalek. Eccleston had a family emergency, which might have involved his father, and he had to be absent from filming for a week or two. And maybe that's what you heard.
Yeah.
That wasn't. I don't believe he didn't see. As far as I know, he didn't have any family members on set.
Oh well, yeah. That's just that.
Billy Piper had her sisters on set.
A couple
of times. They didn't get in the show, but they did get into one of the DVD extras where they gave Billy Piper a camera and she went around filming stuff, and including her sisters trying to get pose with the actor who played Adam in Dalek.
Oh.
Because they thought he was cute.
I know. I think I picked it up from one of the boards or something. So they're probably wrong that that he was in it. And then the whole thing with supposedly kill the Doctor, right? The Reapers.
And of course that gets reversed when the time paradox is finally resolved at the end when Pete Tyler finally lets the car run him over like it should have done.
Yeah, then he gets hit, and then of course the Doctor reappears and go to him while he can. It just is amazing, and then they go back to Jackie talking to the younger Rose, saying, "Oh, some young girl came out and was with your father before he died." It's amazing how I really like the program. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's exactly the kind of writing we saw in those Wilderness years, and it's great to be able to see it depicted on television and for millions of people who aren't Doctor Who fans, who bought every book and listen to every audio, to be able to share that with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got that in Father's Day. They're going to get it in the rest of the series. And it just keeps on like this.
Yeah, and then of course, Koenig mentioned as well that the K-9 and Sarah Jane show up in the second season, right?
Yes, now in the second season has been running in Britain now for 3 weeks. They just had episode 3 on this past Saturday, and in that was called School Reunion, and it featured Sarah Jane Smith, the investigative journalist who was a companion of the Doctor for 3 and a bit seasons in the 70s. She's investigating the same thing that the Doctor is, and they cross paths. And she has with her the model of K-9 that the Doctor once sent her as a present after her travels with him was done, and that was done for a potential spin-off series back in 1981, which got as far as a pilot, which was called K-9 and Company. And that's how she had K-9 Mark III. We saw him again very briefly in the Five Doctors 20th anniversary special, and he's occasionally cropped up in fan fiction and books and things. But we were, I for one was very surprised that they would go back and bring Sarah and K-9 back together, but they did it in this episode, and there's been rumors that they were going to go on to another a spin-off series of their own now, Yeah, but those are not true. That seems to be the British tabloids getting confused between the spin-off series that was and what is really going to happen, which is the writer, one of the co-writers who created K-9 partly owns the copyright on K-9, and he's able to take him and shop him around to other studios, other networks, and he's arranged to have a CG animated series starring K-9 called K-9 Adventures, which is
going
to run on a satellite channel in Europe. And he originally pitched this to the BBC, I believe, but they thought with Doctor Who and with Torchwood that they already had enough going, that they didn't want to further muddy the issue. But because he partly owns the copyright, as long as K-9 doesn't look quite the same as he does on the BBC, which he won't in the cartoon, he'll be rebuilt somewhat and redesigned.
Yeah.
As long as that happens, they can take him and do whatever they want. And he's also the co-creator of Wallace and Gromit.
Oh.
So you've got the clout to be able to go and do something like that.
Oh, very cool. Now, what's the story with Billie Piper? Now, there are rumblings that she's not going to be back. She'll be back for most of the third season, but not all of it. Is that right?
I've heard rumors going both ways.
Oh.
And I believe this time there's probably a lot of disinformation being thrown around, because one of the disappointments of last season was the fact that Christopher Eccleston's leaving leaked out so soon. I mean, the show debuted on March the 26th last year and got 11 million viewers. It was tremendous hit.
Yeah.
And on the Wednesday of the following week, they announced that they picked up the second season. And 4 hours later, someone in the BBC press office who... I hope lost his job, leaked the fact that Chris Eccleston's contract had not been renewed for the second season.
Huh.
And they then had to try and spin that into a story of why he left, which they made up, and he made them retract. But yes, it leaked out way too soon that Chris Eccleston was leaving at the end of the season. I suspect that some of the stuff that says she's staying for the third season might be rumor control, might be them throwing out conflicting stories, so you won't know what's going to happen at the end of the second season. We don't know for certain whether she's staying into the third. We know she's here for the whole second year.
Wow.
But what's going on next year, we don't know.
Wow, because she's incredible on that show. I mean,
She is fantastic. She won. She and Chris Eccleston both won acting awards over there that are voted on by the public.
Mm.
And, yeah, whenever they're on screen, I think they're pretty much out acting anything else you see on television that night.
Huh. That's amazing. Well, Invincor or Steve, whatever you call you, we're at the end of our program. We'll let you go.
Okay.
Okay, well, to bring you on again, it was very, very enlightening, very informative. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Very welcome. Have a good night now. There he goes. There he goes.
Good night.
We're going to get the Dalek in there somehow.
Yeah,
thanks.
That's what I've got.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Uh-oh, there he goes. Up into the TARDIS. There goes Invincor to parts unknown. Maybe he's going to Caprica next, so I don't know. We'll see. And Koenig Rules will be back next week. He's got spoilers like you wouldn't believe coming up next week. Or boilers. He's got boilers. Anyway, thank you, Roy, for being on the program. Thank you, Invincor. Thank you very much. Thank you, Michael J.W. Stickings. Thank you to Ken from the Spokesman Review newspaper. And thank you to Consoler, the Centurion Charge of Production. And tomorrow is 10 till 12 is Daily Noise. And Friday is Spank Wagon, followed by King Hesh. I'm Sean.